Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'm talking with Jaakko Hamann, Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, Just Traveling, God, Leaving Home, and a Spirituality for the Road. Jaakko, thanks for being willing to do yet another interview with me.
Chris, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
Sure. You just got back from a trip across the country to Alaska, and you'll be heading off for a year-long out-of-country research leave, so the pandemic evidently hasn't completely quashed your urge to travel. But that's now, when the situation is, however else it might be described, different from the early days of the pandemic. What were your travel experiences during the early days, and in what way, in other words, in what ways, if any, did you travel in 2020 and 2021?
Yeah, so Chris, I try to do extensive traveling every other year to spend the off year research and writing. And so in 2019, I did a massive road trip of covering the four corners of the U.S., which is Madawaska, Maine, and then Key West, and then in Florida, and then San Ysidro in California, and then Blaine, Washington State. We also managed to go to the Amazon as a family in 2019, so that was big travel. So when 2020 broke, I basically just stayed home and worked on a book project. But 2021, COVID was still pretty much running around in aggressive ways. And I did manage to do one significant road trip that took me out to the Colorado Rockies, the national parks of Utah, the Grand Canyon, up to Yellowstone and back. So I've managed to travel at least by motorcycle, which is a safer way of traveling than flying. I have managed to travel despite COVID, the COVID pandemic, and it's been interesting to see the pending travels. We'll be traveling extensively over the next year, and COVID stays on your mind as a traveler. I can tell you that.
So before we explore the specifics of what it means to be or engage in just traveling, and that's the, I mean, there's a little ambiguity there in the title of your book. I wanted to ask you a few questions about some of the terms and concepts that undergird the book as a whole. Early in the book, you note the distinction that folks sometimes make between travel and tourism. So what do you mean by travel, and how does it differ from tourism, and why does it matter to distinguish these two?
Yeah, so in my book, I argue, Chris, that traveling and tourism has a lot of overlap. I mean, we all leave the home to go somewhere to return. Now, the folklorist and anthropologist Arnold van Gennep, or van Gennep, I guess, in anglicized ways, he would say that is a rite of passage. So there's lots of overlap between traveling and tourism. But I think the big difference for me is that when you travel, there's a liminal quality that is not present when I'm just a tourist. For instance, when I'm a tourist, I would love for my plane to leave on time, my bags to arrive, the weather must be good, the food must be good and not give me any bugs, people should leave me alone, and I just want to lounge by the pool with a drink in my hand, or something of that kind. Traveling implies an openness to experiences, to meeting people. I think we typically do it at a slower pace. We try to discover at a deeper level than maybe the pool next to a resort hotel. And so I do think that, yeah, despite traveling and being a tourist or tourism has a significant overlap, there is a significant difference. And I would argue that the difference is this liminal quality of transformation. I think when we travel, we are transformed in ways that we are not transformed when we just jump on a plane to quickly go somewhere for a week.
And we'll explore in more detail some of that. But when we travel, according to you, we're also traveling with not only perhaps the humans that go with us, but also with God. And so central to the argument of your book is that God, whom you call the Earth Roamer, is in some way involved in travel, is a traveler in God's own way. And I don't know that you say this in the book, but it struck me that God not only travels, as you detail in the book, but God is also said to have a dwelling in Zion, a house in Jerusalem. So I wanted to ask you, in what ways is God an earth roamer, as you discuss in the book, and in what ways is God also a destination? And how are these notions related, if they are?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So when I researched the book, I was struck that the early narratives in Scripture that we have in the Bible about God, so that would be narratives in the books of Genesis and Exodus, for instance, in all of those narratives, God is always on the move. Mm. There's never really a stationary image of God. And you may remember in the Exodus narrative how God became a cloud by day and a ball of fire by night, but God was always on the move. And then if you look at some of the New Testament stories around Jesus was an itinerant preacher. Mm. He just went from place to place, always being on the move as well. And since I argue that we are made into the image of this God who's always on the move, I think traveling is in our DNA, it's in our blood. We want to travel, we want to go places. And so there is then this little paradox, I think, that you've highlighted, that God is also depicted as having a house in Zion, etc. But then remember, that house was destroyed, and in the end, I think the image that we get from a person like the Apostle Paul, that maybe we just live in tents, which again gives the image that we're always on the road. Mm-hmm. And so I think rather than imagining God as a destination, for instance, I'm not personally curious about heaven so much, but I am curious about how can we make heaven realized here on earth. How can we do that? Mm-hmm. Because God moves with us wherever I go, I do think the potential of bringing in the values of God, of loving neighbor, being kind, being gracious, being just, all of those values we can take with us even when we're on the road.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And kind of related to this, also sort of a general question, and one that's somewhat came to the top of my mind in a way that could have been in our previous conversations, is your relationship to the Bible. Traveling for you is, among other things, traveling with the Bible and its many examples of not only God on the move, but people on the move. And you know, we've talked about a lot of books, but I don't think I've ever asked you about the importance of the Bible to your work as a professor of religion, psychology, and culture. So you're not a biblical studies professor, but not every professor in a divinity school is necessarily that attached to the Bible. So where does that come from for you?
Yeah. So I think I've always been fascinated by the stories that's in the Bible, because I think they are archetypal stories. They tell us something fundamentally about the sacred, our relationship to the earth. It tells us something fundamental about who we are as human beings, about being in community, of creating community. And so we have narratives that I think are filled with wisdom and can speak to all people in all places, which is actually, I think, if we look at how the Bible has just proliferated around the world, it is kind of what happened. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so curious about, is this the objective truth or something? I am curious about what is the story, the narrative, and what lessons of wisdom are contained within these stories? And the stories become important for me because I think in this postmodern world that is technologically driven, persons have lost touch with stories to live into. Mm. We don't live by stories anymore. We just live on whatever Twitter gives us every 10 seconds. And so we have these fleeting moments, but we don't have an overarching narrative that we can say, I like this narrative. I want to be part of this story and I want to live into it. So what I do is I then engage as somebody interested in psychology, for instance. I think psychologically we cannot flourish without broader narratives to live into. Mm-hmm. We just cannot do that. Psychology would affirm that for us. And so I then volunteer these 2,000 and a half to 3,000 year old stories. I volunteer those as narratives still worthy to live into. Mm-hmm. And that's my real intrigue about these biblical stories. They teach us something about ourselves that we won't find through technology. Mm. And it's an invitation to really discover the fullness of life, which I think is challenging in today's world to find.
Mm-hmm. Great. We're going to turn now to a focus on the specifics of the book. And thank you. I did not know that it was Arnold von Hennef. Just Traveling is structured actually around an expansion of Arnold von Hennep's three-part schema from his book, The Rites of Passage. Separation, and the one that you've mentioned already, the differentiation between travel and tourism, which is liminality or a transition, and then incorporation. So von Hennep had this sort of view of rites of passage having these three moments that a person goes through. Your rites of passage are an expansion on this, and we're going to look at each one of them. They are anticipating, leaving, surrendering, meeting, caring, and returning. And just a warning to listeners, you're going to need to read the book to get the details about all of this. So the first rite of passage, the anticipating, actually the first chapter, which is on anticipating, covers the first two, anticipating and leaving. And so I'm going to ask you a question about the anticipation part of that chapter. To clarify what you mean by anticipation, you set out some contrasts, anticipation versus expecting, futurum versus adventus. So I wonder if you could talk about those contrasts and how they help you get at what's involved in the concept of anticipation.
Yeah, so long before we go on a travel trip, we anticipate that we will be going. Mm-hmm. We plan, we think ahead. But back to these archetypal stories, if you put on the lens of anticipation, you discover that in those early narratives, anticipation permeate every single story. So the story says Adam was made from the topsoil, not the dust, the topsoil of the earth. He anticipated a partner, and there weren't any. Then Eve anticipated that you could get wisdom by just eating a fruit. Didn't quite happen that way. Now they can anticipate to labor for food and have pain in childbirth. Their sons Cain and Abel, Cain anticipated that his offer would be accepted to God. It wasn't, and then he kills his brother. So in those early narratives, anticipation just is all over every single story. So I argue that anticipation is this powerful magnet that can pull us into the future. But it is, as philosophers would argue, it is empty, by which they mean I anticipate the future, but we do not know exactly how that future will unfold. Mm-hmm. Because once we're on the road trip or once we are traveling, things will happen that we never anticipated. And so we have to go with an open spirit to experience that. And that's where Jürgen Moltmann comes in. The theologian Moltmann says that we can experience time in a variety of ways. He said one of the ways we experience time would be the futurum. The futurum is literally the calendars we live by. I mean, you and I talked about this interview for many months, actually, and then we scheduled over weeks to get to this point where we are today. So that's all futurum stuff. But then Moltmann says, life is best lived with Adventus moments. And Adventus, Advent, it means the sacred or God breaking into our reality, and then our realities change because of that breaking in of God's life force. And so anticipation is empty because you anticipate things happening that you never thought of. Mm-hmm. But anticipation is this powerful dynamic that I think even in the COVID pandemic, people naturally gravitated towards that because they would anticipate a time when we are not under the restraints and the care we had to extend to ourselves and others of not traveling,
right,
just to be healthy and have to be safe. So anticipation is this wonderful moment where we can anticipate actually for months before we leave. And the joy that we have, the Dutch has a beautiful word for anticipation, which is voorpret. Voorpret literally means the joy before.
Mm.
The joy before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what anticipation is. It brings us joy and even a sense of peace, maybe in moments when we need to have those experiences.
Right. Anticipation, then the actual leaving, which you associate with disloyalty. So one question I have about that is why? But the other question is, as was the case, literally during the height of the pandemic, but in other situations as well. What happens when you can't leave? You anticipate, but you can't leave.
Yeah.
So why is leaving disloyal? And what happens when you're kept from leaving?
Yeah. I think the disloyalty, Chris, comes in a variety of forms. The one is whenever you leave people behind.
Mm.
There are family members and friends who do not go with you on the experience, and that feels emotionally as a form of disloyalty. I think there's also disloyalty in just the privilege of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
It costs money, it takes time. Not everybody can go on a trip like I just did, which was a 6-week motorcycle ride to Alaska. Not everybody can do that. So there's all kinds of disloyalty in that reality or version of life. But I also think there's disloyalty in that we travel because we consciously or unconsciously want to affirm that there is something lacking in our life right now, something gone awry. I use some psychological theories from Barbara Pryor and others to argue that we have knots in our life, things that is just not optimal, and we want to untie those knots. And traveling is one way of doing it. I'll give you an example out of my trip to Alaska just now. So during the COVID pandemic, I don't even know exactly how I got into this habit of drinking Diet Coke, but I would drink easily 6 to 8 cans of Diet Coke a day.
Wow.
And I knew it's not good for me. I know it was tied to stress and caffeine, and I was a little bit overworked and overloaded the last couple of years. So I knew it was tied to that,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't a healthy pattern. So when I went on this ride, the first knot that I told myself I have to untie is figure out my relationship with Diet Coke and change it. I need to do that. And I think that's the luxury of being on a trip, is you can untie the knots. And so yes, because there's all kinds of caffeine withdrawal that goes along with not drinking Diet Coke anymore, I had a headache for a day or two. And then I haven't had a Diet Coke in many, many, many weeks because I could untie the knot.
Right.
And so that is, I think, some of the disloyalty that I'm talking about. It is acknowledging that life is not optimal at the moment. I need to change something in my life. Mm-hmm. And for each one of us, it might be a relationship, it might be a habit or a pattern of behavior. But whatever it is, we want to let something go.
So would it be true to say then, in a way, that loyalty isn't always such a good thing?
No, it's not. You have to become disloyal,
in a sense.
Yeah. You have to become disloyal. And especially as you grow and you experience new worldviews, mm-hmm. where you become disloyal to your family of origins mm-hmm. worldview because mm-hmm. you grew out of that, mm-hmm. that is absolutely the case. So what happens if you cannot go mm-hmm. on a trip? I think it is actually experienced as a sense of loss because we've anticipated mm-hmm. the trip, the travel. It has become alive in us as a mental object. Mm-hmm. And so when, for some reason, we cannot travel, a deep sense of loss sets in. Losses can only be mourned and grieved. We cannot replace a loss. So it's not about, oh, I'll just go on another trip. You can do that. You have to sort of recognize the melancholia that will set in when a door closes for you, for instance, on a possible travel. During the pandemic, a lot of that happened. Especially around traveling to funerals, when family members who died could not travel because of all kinds of restrictions. My own mother died in South Africa, and I have yet to be there since her death, because when she died, there were no funerals allowed. I could not travel easily and safely. And so how do you mourn and grieve those losses? That's the task that we have to do.
Wow. Surrendering is the focus of the next chapter of Just Traveling. And you talk about surrender in relation to liberation, which might strike some readers as paradoxical, partly because of how folks might conceive of the concept of surrendering. After all, isn't traveling at least something other than business traveling? Though perhaps even that, to some extent, all about freeing oneself from one's daily routines, experiencing different places, different people, a different you. So what does it mean when you talk about surrender? To what or whom is a person surrendering? And then what does freedom mean in the context of surrendering?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the West definitely has a very warped understanding of surrendering as waving a white flag and you've just lost and we want to be winners. But if we go to Japan and other Asian and East Asian cultures, surrendering has a very different meaning of deeper dependency upon other people, deeper connection to humanity. It has connections of being tolerant and being understanding. So when I say we have to surrender, I imply that you open yourself up to the experiences you are having and not necessarily the things you planned when you anticipated. On this ride to Alaska, I was deeply struck by the impact of climate change because the permafrost is melting. The road conditions as you get to the Alaska Highway or the Cassiar Highway roads that I took were in very, very poor condition. Permafrost is melting and the road literally is just sinking in. And so I hit a couple of potholes so hard that I blew the front shocks of my motorcycle.
Wow.
And so I had to find a place to repair. The closest place to repair is Edmonton for me at that point, because I'm already on the Alaska Highway. And then the Alaska Highway promptly washes out with like a 30-yard gash in this one road. There is no bypasses you can easily take. So now I get pushed on to the Cassiar Highway that pushes me out to basically northeast of Vancouver. And I have to make it all across Canada again to get to Edmonton with a bike that is not optimally functioning at this moment. So what is surrendering? Surrendering is not being angry and frustrated with my shocks that blew, with the road that washed out. But as I had to diminish my speed big time, going much slower, going a massive detour, to recognize that on this new road, I can also learn something. I can meet new people now that I never thought I would be meeting. I would be seeing places I never thought I would visit. And surrendering is opening yourself up. So why do I have to surrender? I have to surrender my sense that I'm in control of my own journey. I have to surrender that I am an independent traveler. I needed the help of other people. I needed the hospitality of the road, that even though I'm in very desolate parts of Canada, that there'll be a place to sleep, that'll be food and gas, things like that. So surrendering, I think, challenges us in our strong sense of independence here in the West. It challenges us in our sense of individuality. And it opens us up to a common humanity that is very life-giving, I think, if we allow ourselves to get reattached to being a member of the human race,
right,
and not just being me,
right,
where I use I a lot. And so that's what surrendering is. It is, I think, one of the core aspects of spiritual maturity is if we can surrender to our experiences rather than trying to control it the whole time.
I can actually see, and maybe this is a Western way of thinking it, how freedom is connected to this, because in a sense, I mean, you had a plan and you were going to follow that plan, and that plan was thrown awry, but in a sense it opens up a kind of weird freedom to experience something that you wasn't part of the plan, which can be scary.
You know, absolutely. I mean, even just in, as I was limping towards Edmonton, driving and riding my motorcycle at a much slower pace, to suddenly recognize, why was I so rushed for thousands of miles, going at high speeds the whole time? There's freedom just even to slow down and to spend more time with people.
Right.
There's freedom in that. I think when we seek control, we are chained to ways that is not kind to us or to other people for that matter. So we can find freedom when we surrender ourselves. And I think it's very akin to what we learn about mindfulness meditation, for instance, where it is how can you be in touch with where your body is now, what is happening now? How can you stop your mind racing ahead, ahead from yourself? So I think there's lots of interplay with what we know from psychology and other places of life and research.
The chapter that follows is on meeting. And some of these chapters, the progression isn't necessarily the same progression as von Hennep's. I mean, you have sort of overlaps. So you meet, you, as we'll see, you care, but you do these things simultaneously throughout the entire rite of passage, I guess you could call it. So the chapter that follows is on the concept of meeting. And early in that chapter, you recount several awkward or unsettling anecdotes about meeting during your own travels, as well as one that I at least took as fairly positive. What are the different ways in which we meet others on our travels, and what are some ways of making those meetings more positive for everybody?
Yeah.
if you can control that kind
if
of thing.
If you can control that. So if you travel, I think discovering other persons and cultures is one of the gifts of traveling. But when you do so, you are immediately confronted by the vast differences between the way that you live and see the world and the way that other people live and see and see the world. I sometimes wonder, as somebody who speaks English as a second language, I sometimes wonder, can I really meet another person if I speak English? Because English is also the language of the colonizer. It is either the historic colonizer or it is the contemporary colonizer, but it is the colonizer. And how can we speak a language that assures we will meet each other in wonderful ways? So I pick up on Homi Bhabha and other folk, the critical theorist, who reminds us that we all come from such a specific location, which gives us a certain worldview, and that it's really difficult to understand somebody else's location and where they come from. We best need what physicians Melanie Tervelon and Jan Marie Garcia calls cultural humility, which is a openness to move into a community, into a relationship, and basically to say that, help me understand where you live and where you come from and how you think, and how this community thrives and flourishes, and what are the concerns for this community. I think meeting is really, really difficult. So it takes us beyond the financial transactions that's almost always inherent in tourism, because tourism is always exchanging money. Whereas traveling, I think, is much more encouraging us to exchange lives. And what would that look like? I can give you a feel, and that takes us maybe to your next question. But on this ride up to Alaska, I stopped in Edmonton for a few days to learn from the homeless population in Edmonton, and to learn from the people who serve that community. And it was absolutely eye-opening. It changed my whole ride going forward, because I was hyper-alert of persons who may not have a secure home to stay in at this moment. So there's lots of ways how we can meet people on the road. Volunteering would be one way.
Well, and yeah, you're right. I mean, the whole idea of meeting is related to caring, which is what you talk about next. And the subtitle for that chapter on caring is Redeeming Privileged Irresponsibility and Building Solidarity. I would think listeners by this point have gotten the idea that what Jaakko Hamann is talking about when he talks about travel is a little bit different than what they might think, but I'll just say, some folks might think travel is, you know, about throwing away our cares, being less responsible than we regularly are. Yet you're saying no. Travel is about caring. So, what do you mean when you talk about privileged irresponsibility? That's one question. With whom are we building solidarity? And what do these have to do with a vacation trip to, say, Dollywood, Detroit, or Denmark?
So privileged irresponsibility is a concept that care theorist Joan Tronto uses. And it's basically speaking to a person being so privileged that they do not have to care. It's about being so privileged you do not have to care. So, for instance, an example she will use is you see somebody struggling and you just give them a dollar or two. Now that person has to take that dollar or two and turn it into something that is really caring for them. Maybe food or something. You don't know this person at all. You just passed the buck to them. That's all you did.
Literally.
And so I argue that when we travel, there's lots of ways how we can overcome that kind of a mindset, that we don't have to care. We don't have to care about the people we visit. We don't have to care about the places we visit. The easiest way to overcome that is really to slow down your travels and volunteer with whatever interest you have. along the road. So I'm interested in housing quite a bit. And so in Anchorage, I volunteered with Habitat for Humanity for a couple of days. Mm. It was easily set up, but now I know a local family. I've painted the homes, the rooms in which they will sleep. Mm. I've discovered the stories, how they came to be in need of this specific piece of housing. And my understanding of Anchorage is forever changed. Mm-hmm. It's not I go to Anchorage and eat halibut fishing or I enjoy all the lovely microbreweries that's there because they have wonderful microbreweries. Now I have people and places that has been changed because I cared a little bit enough to say I can stay for 2-3 days, slow down, get to meet people and engage in a caring act of some kind. Regardless of your interest, whether it's climate change, whether it's animals, doesn't matter what your interests are, you will be able to make a difference wherever you go. Mm-hmm. And I think it just takes a little bit of planning, a little bit of communication. But technology is wonderful to find those opportunities to invest in a place that's not yours, in a people that's not your family or your people. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what makes traveling really rich, is when we begin to care about the places we visit. And the caring can continue when we return. We can, for instance, plan a return trip. We can learn more about the issues, for me, for instance, the issues around homelessness in Alaska. We can figure out, if you are intrigued about language, you can pick up the language of the place you visited. You can keep connections with folk that you have met along the road. The care can continue long after you've returned home.
Right. And I mean, this segues nicely into the last chapter of this, these rite of passages. Although I was, you know, as with so many of these other elements along the way, returning itself is the last, but it's something that you anticipate, as you say, in the book. Returning, as you write, is can be fraught in a number of ways. As you suggested, travel can change us, which leads to changes in relationships with those with whom we travel, those whom we leave behind. So what are some of the things that happen when we return from traveling? And how can we show caring in the ways we relate to ourselves, the people we left behind, and just the whole experience of travel that remains with us after we've returned?
Yeah, so family therapists will remind us that all entrances and exits will raise the anxiety in a family system, and then conflict is more likely. Mm. So when we return from a travel, that is a significant entrance in a variety of systems, and you can expect a little bit of tension in your house and in your friendships and in the workplace, because that would be normal. But also, I think emotionally, more intrapsychically, returning is really difficult because you have to adjust from the different culture you've met, the freedom you've had traveling, the different commitments you had compared to being at home. And then I think what sets in is almost a form of melancholia, a form of blues, a depressive-like state when we return. But by remembering the trip, by being kind and graceful to ourselves, by having self-compassion, for instance, we can overcome those experiences when we return. And so returning is a wonderful experience because we have been transformed, but because we've just returned, we may not be able to tell people how we've been transformed. And it will take probably weeks and months to figure that out. How have you been changed by untying a few knots along the way? Mm-hmm. Who are you as the new you, in a sense? And so I think returning is challenging, it's difficult, but it's also beautiful because it probably will be the moment you anticipate that next travel, that next trip. And for me, the moment I came home, I've already started plotting, you know, where can I turn my motorcycle's wheels to next? The next year, as you said, I'll be on the road quite a bit. I'll be out of country, but when I come back, the summer of 2024, I can anticipate there'll be an exciting ride ahead.
That's great. So I wanted to bring this to a close with a final question that sort of takes us back to talking a little bit about the pandemic. Toward the end of Alain Botton's The Art of Travel, which you refer to in your book, it's a wonderful little book that I actually read in Taiwan. The author discusses Javier de Maistre's two volumes, Journey Around My Bedroom and Nocturnal Expedition Around My Bedroom. De Botton characterizes de Maistre's mode of travel as room travel, a type of travel that's become quite familiar to many folks during the pandemic, especially those who live in apartments or condos, where the chances of encountering others and getting infected were higher than for people living in relatively more spacious surroundings. So at the end of your book, you acknowledge that traveling may look different in the future due to the effects of the pandemic that we're still living in. Though on the surface, it appears that many folks in the U.S. are happy to get back to moving around the country or the world if indeed some of them ever stopped. Is there anything we can learn about traveling from our recent experience of shrunken horizons? Or should we just consider the last couple of years from a travel perspective as a moment best forgotten as we try to recover the mobility that we had prior to COVID?
Yeah. Chris, I think we can learn a lot about our shrunken horizons, as you say. I think the one thing that we can learn is that the life force of the Earth roamer is alive in every person. I think every person wants to travel. Every person wants to go beyond their own boundaries. And I think we see that post-pandemic, well, not even post-pandemic because it's not post yet, but we are in a different phase with the pandemic, how national parks have record numbers of people coming. In these last weeks, we saw chaos at European airports with too many travelers and not enough staff. So I do think it's in our human DNA, as I've said, that we want to travel. So I think that's what we can learn, is that the pandemic or a pandemic is not going to curb our travel wandering lust. I mean, we would love to go out and experience the world. But I think we also discovered in the pandemic that sometimes traveling is not about distance. Mm. Maybe it is literally just taking you out of your familiar context and engaging what is different. And for many people, that can be even a mile away. Mm. Just a mile away, you can discover a new community, new friendships, things of that kind. So I think the pandemic has forced us to be more focused locally. Mm. I think the pandemic brought in a little bit of paranoia and mistrust between people. Mm-hmm. Can I meet you if you don't wear a mask? You know? And I do think it will look different. The one thing that I think is going to stay the same, though, is that people will travel. People will be transformed, and they will take this transformed selves back home, which I think makes them more kind, more loving, more gracious, because that is the gift of traveling. Mm. It opens up your worldview and yourself in life-giving ways.
Jaco, thanks again for this conversation. And welcome back, and may your future travels be as surprising as you might not anticipate.
I have every confidence it will be. Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been talking with Jaakko Haaman, professor of religion, psychology, and culture, and director of the program in theology and practice, about his recent book, Just Traveling, God, Leaving Home, and a Spirituality for the Road, published by Fortress Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page, or send me an email at chris.benda@vanderbilt.edu. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.